Hi, everybody. Hugh McLeod here with Hugh and the Rabbi Podcast number 4. I'm here with my usual gang of co-conspirators. First, we have Rabbi Pinny Gunewicz.
Hello, everybody.
My favorite marketing contrarian, Johnny Moore.
Hey, Hugh.
And a Scottish guy, I can't remember his name. Oh, Ewan Semple, who's a consultant, but before that he was building all the groovy Web 2.0 stuff at the BBC. And before that...
Oh, I still can't cope with people calling me a consultant, you don't.
Okay, all right. I don't know what to call it. What do I call you? I mean, you know, you're just kind of one of these kind of guys that flies around kind of like a rock star.
Yeah.
And everybody says, you're terribly clever, let's pay you lots of money.
That's right.
Okay, and Mark Earl sadly can't be with us this week, but we'll see him again soon. Okay, here's what I was thinking, gang. Last week we were talking about something. I went around for years talking about the blogosphere saying, oh, the blogosphere is fueled by goodwill, yada, 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 you know, goodwill. Because, you know, everybody was doing things because they liked you, because nobody was paying you. You just did it because you thought it was cool. And then about 2 years ago, actually a year last June to be more precise, I saw Ewan here give a talk at Reboot in Copenhagen. And he was kind of talking about how cool and groovy Web 2.0 was. And he actually used the L word. He said, a lot of what makes this special, or a lot of what makes this work, is love. And I went, Eureka. And ever since then, I've been using the L word all the time, making people sick to their stomachs. But Ewan, could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, happily, Hugh. And in fact, I listened to the podcast. I kind of caught what you were saying about it the last time. And it was funny because I think some people's reactions to the L word is, you know, they're not comfortable with it. I mean, let's face it, people aren't comfortable with the word social in business environments either. And I think the what I was saying basically was it's about connections. It's about people's basic desire to connect with each other that keeps the whole thing going. It's why people become obsessive about Facebook or Twitter or whatever. It's just this ability to connect with each other. And but also about getting into things and being passionate about things and caring about things. You know, and in fact, I was posting on my blog recently again about love, and it was kicked off by reading about Steve Jobs and the iPhone and how they've all been complaining about their own mobile phones and hearing other people complaining about mobile phones. And he said they wanted to make a device that they would all love. And obviously wasn't squeamish about using that word. And he, at a different part in the interview, also spoke about when they're recruiting people to Apple, they want to find people who will love working for the place. And, you know, one of the things I find as I kind of, you know, go to work with different corporations and different kind of business environments is there's a whole range of different attitudes to passion, love, commitment, social, whatever. And so much of the business world is sanitized that kind of stuff out of it, and it just seems weird.
I think what's interesting is, you know, I've been thinking about, you know, how companies show love. You know, what's his name? One of the great Saatchi people wrote a book called Love Marks, and which is a pretty, it's not a great book, but it's a pretty good book.
Kevin Robbins.
Yeah, Kevin Robbins. And the interesting thing I think about is that in love and in marriage or relationships, whatever it is, if you don't go to the nth degree, then everything else doesn't count. So if you buy presents and you do this and you do all the good things, but you don't take the garbage out, everything else you did didn't count. It's like, what did I do wrong? I'm doing everything wrong. No, you didn't go the nth mile. And I think companies that you know, dot all the I's, but they do it for the PR or they do it, you know, to get their name to do something, and then someone finds a loophole that they didn't go to the nth degree. People, especially in the blogosphere, will pounce on that. And I think, you know, companies like when Facebook did not own up to the whole situation they had with Beacon, or when Apple didn't allow other people to create programs, they got flack, and that's why they opened up. So I think companies need to go to the nth degree when you talk about love.
Oh, I don't know about that, Hugh. I don't know about that. You got me provoked now, Penny. I thought it'd be good to have some controversy this week because I can't stand that book, Love Marks. Because I think that, I mean, obviously people will use the word love to mean different things. And I think that kind of fanatical idea of love is not what I think is not what I think makes web interesting. It's not the love, if you like, that I've experienced and I've sort of experienced more of in the last few months, which seems to me less about proving yourself in every single way to be the most perfect and attentive lover, but more about just being kind of real and human. And I get the point about putting the rubbish out. I think it's the small gestures often tell us more about the relationship. But I think I'm wary, and especially when people talk about love in business, to mean something that sounds sometimes kind of unreasonable, or the kind of love you hear about in pop songs. And I think that's what Love Mark seems to be about. It's not really about love as a genuine sensitivity to people. It's kind of love to make people unreasonably passionate about your brand, not really because it's doing them any good.
Yeah, that's a good point, Johnny. And in many ways, we've kind of got this fixation on the romantic idea of love. That romantic idea has been sort of hyped up, and if it's not flashing lights and violence and all that kind of stuff, it's not meaningful, even in a romantic context. And you know, you often sort of think about things like arranged marriages, which, you know, culturally in the West are seen as being a bad thing. But in many ways, it kind of deflates all that overhyped expectation and gets it back down to just the ability to coexist
and raising children and getting on with it.
Exactly, and in some ways, that's you know, that's kind of more what I meant by love in the context of work. It's about commitment and about longevity and a kind of passion that grows out of day-to-day stuff rather than some romantic ideal.
Well, speaking of speaking of like this day-to-day stuff, you're the new, shall we say, guest on the show, and so I think maybe spend some time on your background here on this subject. See, before you're doing all this kind of 2.0 stuff, the Beeb, you were working the BBC World Service, I believe. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yep.
And if there's a company that kind of embodies, you know, people who are very dedicated and kind of love what they do and love what they're about and love their audience in a kind of long term way, it would be the BBC, or at least the World Service part of it.
Well, yeah, I'm glad you added that rider.
But could you tell us here how these attitudes you have were informed by your time working for the World Service?
Yeah, well spotted, Ewan. I mean, very much so. There's a couple of things that I reckon were significant about the World Service that have stayed with me. One of them was the fact that you've got 47, I don't know how many it is these days, but roughly 47 different language services all working in the same building. So these are people, native speakers from different countries who've come across to Britain to broadcast back. In some cases, in the old days, certainly in the days of the Iron Curtain, in some very adverse circumstances. So they were, you know, they were interesting people, characters. But the fact was, you had all these different cultural backgrounds. So you were, you know, if you were climbing ladders, they were all against different walls. So it meant that there was much less ego, there was much less tribalism, and certainly than I experienced in the rest of the BBC, and a much kind of greater ability to tolerate and be tolerant of each other and just rub shoulders. And that was a kind of very formative thing. The other thing was that my job was as a sound engineer, a studio manager, and I worked across in the whole range of those language services and the English language output. And we were like our own virus, if you like. We moved from one place to the other. We had to get on quickly with people in very scary circumstances sometimes. They're about to live broadcast, whatever. And just that ability to engage with people, connect with people, and then move ideas around the building, again, felt like a formative experience. And the last one is I guess goes back to what I was saying about corporates, that, you know, the product, if you like, of the World Service is ideas. It's getting into people's heads. You are privileged to do so. Sometimes it was very humbling when people from you know, one guy from Bangladesh came over who'd been listening since he was a youngster, and you know, that was 40-50 years, and just the awe in his eyes coming to this place that had pumped these ideas out for all that length of time. And it's kind of that intimacy as well that you get with radio that I think is kind of effectively in all of our hands now with the web and podcasting and stuff. And it's the same sense of obligation as to people allowing, you know, as they will do with this podcast, allowing us into their heads.
And this goes back to what you're talking about. It kind of reminds me of what Mark Earls likes to talk about, which is the first, what do you call it, the purpose idea. where instead of saying, you know, what is our brand essence, it's much more of a sense of, well, and we talked about this last week in great detail, is what are we here for? Why are we doing this? And trying to get that sense of purpose going and keeping it going. And then you move on, you become, you're not a consultant, don't worry. Mm-hmm. You're trying to take what you learned from the BBC and from all that stuff and apply it to, shall we say, companies that don't quite have such a solid view of purpose.
Well, it's a combination of the purpose, but also obliqueness, if that's not too obscure. I mean, just chatting to Penny before we started this, having been disparaging of podcasts, because I saw a lot of them, and I think a lot of them were and still are, kind of bad attempts at doing what broadcast has done. And I'm becoming less and less of a fan of conventional broadcast in itself anyway. But partly through guys like Leo Laporte and Mike Bright Weekly and Twit, and then through him, the Gilmer Gang, and meandering, and you know, your own stuff you've been doing, Hugh. That kind of meandering set of conversations that, when you listen to them, have a very different way of getting under your skin than kind of being projected at like you normally are in broadcasts. And, you know, I love a lot of aspects of BBC, and I still watch and listen to stuff, but I increasingly find conventional radio output just patronising. I can't cope with the fact that they talk with funny accents, and they, you know, if you were to talk to somebody like that when you're trying to have a conversation with them, you'd be hysterical. And so I think there's this kind of really interesting space, you know, picking up on the intimacy, where like blogging, you can have kind of oblique, meandering, organic kind of chucking around of ideas in a way that looks, you know, kind of look to some people amateurish or frustrating, but actually once you get into the rhythm of it, it's really, really powerful.
That's a great thing about the Gilmore Gang. The other thing about the Gilmore Gang is none of us are being paid for by the British taxpayer, which, unlike the good folk at, what is it, Broadcasting House or wherever, where are they? Home House? Where?
Well, and that's another interesting point here, because I mean, I pay Leo a monthly sum through PayPal that's equivalent to, you know, more than half the license fee.
Wow.
That's me doing that to an individual because I really don't want him to stop podcasting because it really matters to me and I get a lot of joy out of it. And, you know, we used to have these conversations with BBC about the license fee, and lots of them fret about the loss of it. And there's big issues around that and, you know, stuff that we can't really cover now. But I think if you can get to them with something that's really pertinent and passionate and relevant and accessible, people will pay for this stuff.
I always had there's a show on, the British contingents will know this show. It's called called Late Night Review or Late Review. It comes after Newsnight on Fridays.
Yep.
And you've got this Mark Lawson, is that his name? The guy with the glasses?
It is.
And then you've got you've got Jermaine Greer and some guy with his hair slicked back and maybe Kirsty Warwick and all what I call these clever little chaps who are, and I used to live in London. I used to live in London, so I can, shall we say, the kind of Notting Hill, Shepherd's Bush kind of culturally elite of London who get to sit around and talk and say clever things about the latest movies in a very kind of learned, very articulate, very erudite kind of way. And I remember in my 20s watching the show and being fascinated by these people who had jobs just to sit around and be kind of privileged and informed.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a certain kind of, I wouldn't call myself particularly privileged or informed, and I'm not particularly motivated by the privilege of the position. And I always think with, you know, the biggest trouble with media versus, and their traditional media and new media is not so much what the new media is doing, it's the fact that it's eroding their privilege thing.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of people get into media because they're motivated by privilege as opposed to just hard cash. Because you don't go to work for the BBC for the money. You don't go to journalism for the money. You do it because you like the role. And you...
I'd agree. I always remember David Weinberger writing sometime that conversations can only take place between equals.
Ah, oh, I love that.
It's great, isn't it? Because it's, you know, at the point of the conversation, no matter what your status or relative positions, unless you're acting like equals at the point of the conversation, it kind of doesn't work. It isn't a conversation.
Or else you're just holding court. I mean,
that's right.
It's like if you're a well-known blogger like you are, and you're, you know, your reputation is, and and you're at a, like, let's say Reboot or somewhere like that, and you got all these people, kids coming up to you like fanboys. You know, ooh, I love your stuff, and you know, you just feel a bit weird about that because you just want to hang for the same reason everybody else wants to hang.
That's right.
And it's kind of, so I've got a question for Penny because
I'm here.
Yeah, you see, I'm going to remind everybody here that Penny's the only guy here who actually has a real job. he's got his own business, and he's got, you know, ice.com, this online diamond trade. Are people listening to the podcast? Does it affect your business? Do people come up to you in the office, or do people, you know, suppliers come up to you and say, "Hey, check that out"? I guess it's still early days, but is it trickling down into shall we say your business world, and is it having any kind of, not effect so much, but is it changing something?
I don't think it's affecting the business in any way. I think it's affecting I do a lot of e-commerce talks for organizations like shop.org, and whenever I get up to speak, people are like, "Oh, I heard your podcast. It's fantastic. Continue, continue, continue." So I didn't start this podcast at all to have an effect on my business.
Not so much the bottom line, but just the kind of way.
I don't know. I think what it affected is that it added to my thought leader perspective of how people view you know, Penny. So that to me, being on the edge and talking to smart people and throwing ideas around is what it's all about. You know, the fact that we can get together, being in far-flung places around the world, and talk about ideas that matter to me is an honor for me. So the after effects and what comes out, you know, when you gave away all those bottles of wine to all the bloggers, and like you were telling Shell last week,
yeah.
You know, that to me is genius, you know. But what it is it's creating a conversation, but not asking for the conversation, and to me that's the motto of my life. You give and you give and you give, and if you're the one giving, God will give you enough to continuously give.
But how about let's say I'm going to take a hypothetical punt here. So let's say your people who work for you or work with you, they're kind of listening to Penny talk, not just on the podcast, but go to all these other conventions and or these other meetings, these other groups, and talking in this kind of very different way, or maybe a way that's very different to them. Is it making, do you think that example is making them think about the way they talk to the world differently as not just as employees, but as, you know, as a business? Do you think?
I hope so. I hope the fact that just by them living in the office, they're affected by this energy. And you know, we see that we have employees that have been working for us since day one and haven't left, and our attrition rate is very low. So I think it's based on this positive vibe of just giving.
Well, this brings me back to something, a conversation you and I had about a year ago, where I was kind of watching the Robert Scoble phenomenon, or at when he was working for Microsoft, and saying, where the impact for that for me isn't so much Robert changing people's attitudes, consumers' attitudes about Microsoft. It was the disruption inside the company that was the real big story. And I, to paraphrase you, Yoon, I remember you saying something like, when you go to work for a company, the first thing you tell them is how disruptive this new way of communication, this new way of technology is. And so if you're going to use this stuff, be very clear what kind of disruption you're aiming to cause. Would you care to comment on that?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because disruption is another one of these words that has all sorts of baggage. But, you know, there's little doubt that those of us who get excited and involved in this stuff wouldn't be doing so if we didn't think it wasn't going to make a big difference. And, you know, that big difference is going to affect I think, at a profound level, how people see themselves and how they see organisations. And that isn't going to happen without an effect, I think a significant effect, on how they currently see themselves in their organisations. In fact, I was talking this morning to Ross Dawson from Sydney about governance and the whole issue of IT governance and corporate governance and trying to get them ready to accommodate these different expectations. And it's not people had problems the other day with the word revolution that I used in a presentation, again, because of the kind of connotations of that word being negative. This isn't a them and us. It's not a bottom up. It's not a disruptive thing. It's not, the people in the middle and the top have got as much interest in using these types of ways of communicating as people at any fictitious bottom. But it's certainly going to change some of the power dynamics and I think some of the characteristics of who is effective and who's successful and why are going to change in quite a big way. And, I think it's probably better to engage with that with your eyes open than it is pretending it's not going to happen.
I want to talk about what Johnny said before about love. I'm sorry we're getting back to that, but I just got back from my nephew's wedding yesterday, and the interesting thing that I heard over there is that one of the rabbis said a line like this. He says, "Children, kids, you're getting married now, and you're in love with love." Things are going to happen, and hopefully still then, right, you won't be in love with the word love, but you're going to be in love with the other person. So I think when companies I'm not saying that companies need to be perfect. What I'm saying is that if they make a mistake, they need to own up to that right away. And similarly in a relationship. And that's what the rabbi was saying, that you will make mistakes, you will go through valleys, you will have peaks, but just make sure in the valleys you recognize that it's a valley and you own up to it. Never go to sleep in an argument. And I believe companies that try to hide behind their mistakes and then there's an oil spill and then suddenly the ExxonMobil will start giving money to endangered species. I mean, that in my book is garbage. Clean up the oil spill and do it very quickly and don't try to hide behind anything. So, I mean, I think that's what I was trying to say before.
Well, being in Texas, I'm very sympathetic to oil companies because I'm always telling people, well, if you don't like it, if you don't like the oil companies, well, you go down to Guatemala and live down there 8 months a year and get that sludge out of the ground because it's pretty nasty work.
Yeah.
But that's a very reasonable attitude. But my point is, I guess your point is the same thing, is gosh, act like a human being as opposed to a robot.
I'm thinking about what Hugh was saying about intimacy, which you said quite a few minutes ago, Hugh, and how I think that maybe for me that's an even better word than love because to me it points to the ordinary smallness, if you like. You were talking about the world service, that these were not fanatical relationships, but they were quite intimate ones that you're describing. And in these relationships, whether it's companies talking about products, it's that ability to sort of have a real conversation rather than feel under pressure to be always talking about great service and really always putting the customer first, to actually engage in a real way rather than a slightly sort of hypothetical one. I think of this in meetings where when people try very hard to make the meeting really effective, it often just lapses into a slightly fake-o world where we can't really talk to each other in a human way. You take that pressure off and we can shoot the breeze a little and have slightly more casual conversations. Then I think we actually start to feel each other as human beings and cut each other a bit of slack.
Well, it's funny, living in a small town in West Texas has really changed. I don't think I've changed that much, but it's really been strange and wonderful for me watching the human interaction, because I'm thinking this is a small town, 6,000 people. I'd say 75% of them are on minimum wage. Okay, they all make whatever, $6 an hour, whatever it is they make, and a lot of these people don't have a lot of money, and they don't have, a lot of them don't really have really secure jobs. You know, they go from, you know, two nights a week at the hotel and another, you know, three days a week working on a ranch or whatever. And at the same time, small town, because everybody knows their business. And I was in a pool hall, not a pool hall, I was in Harry's Tanaha, which has a pool table behind it. And there's a guy, I don't know, 30 years old, and he's playing pool. He's got like a 10-inch blade on his knife, on his belt buckle, you know, in his sheath, on his belt. He's walking around with basically a killer, you know, something he uses to skin deer because he works on a ranch, but he's walking around with what in Scotland would be considered very much an offensive weapon. But because everybody knows what it's there for, because everybody has a way of dealing with each other, they're not really worried about knives. Whereas if you're in, like, downtown Glasgow, I think you'd probably be in the clinger, don't you think, Ewan?
I'm not sure, actually. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things about Glasgow is it is a small enough place that it is accountable. In fact, I used to find that coming from Glasgow to London, that in Glasgow, if you're going to get beaten up, you'll probably know why, and you might even know who's doing it to you.
And they'll buy you a drink afterwards.
Exactly.
Well, maybe not. Maybe Glasgow is a bad example.
No, but I think a good example would be, you know, I spent some time in Israel recently, and everybody carries a gun there. And people, you know, when you're there the first day, you're like freaked out. You know, then, after like third, fourth day, you're like, okay.
Yeah, and the thing is, it's kind of being in this very small community. You after living in London for so long, where everybody has to make a ton of money all the time, and everybody has to be very, you know, my craft is together, and I'm really on board, and I've got some mortgage, and I've just bought this new BMW, and that amazing pressure to be successful and to be, if you have a lot of people trying to be very successful, then you have a lot of people trying to be very corporate right away. And
yeah. That's a kind of theme for me, isn't it? It's partly driven by the media as well, but that idea of that kind of homogenization of success, you know, you're all trying to do the same things, and you're all competing for the same things, and they all get far too big and far too important. And in fact, for Johnny, when you were talking about the significance of some of this stuff, a phrase from Doc Searls on the last Steve Gilmer Gang came back, things are valuable without being important, which I thought was really, really good, because, you know, important carries all sorts of baggage, crap, doesn't it? Valuables are a thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I guess what, you know, I think of, I guess I speak as someone who spends a lot of time on my own, that maybe I'm more attuned to this, but when I go and stay with my sister and it's Sunday morning and we're reading the papers and I'm reading the paper on one sofa and she's reading another, I realize, oh, this is nice. We're not talking. We're not saying anything. Nothing is being transacted, important or not. But just that background feeling of companionship is very nice. It's very comforting. You can't audit it. You couldn't put it on a spreadsheet. But it's kind of the apparently small stuff that's really holding all this stuff together.
That's why I think
you can get it from web.
That's why I think Twitter works so well, because it's just people,
I agree.
People just nattering about nothing. And that's actually what makes it valuable. If everything has to be about something all the time, it gets a wee bit cold.
And that's what business people just don't get, because they see it as being about nothing. And the question about where's the value, what's the bottom line, what do we have to do, is all barking up the wrong tree.
It is. Although, and here's the really ironic thing, because I keep having quite amazing experiences with Twitter. So here's one that happened to me the other day. Someone who I know as a newish friend tweeted that he'd been moved out of a cafe because he'd spent 2 hours in there and they were fed up with him, even though he'd spent money. And I knew he probably was in the area. I knew he lived around here. And I was in a mood for being on my own that day, but I thought, oh, he's been thrown out. Should we go and have lunch? I said, kind of half expecting him to say no, not altogether sure if I even wanted to go out. But he said yes, so I popped down for lunch. It happened at 10 minutes' notice. And obviously we were meeting for no reason, just because we were in the same area and had nothing else to do. So we schmoozed for 2 hours. I found out a little bit more about him. I talked about me. We rambled around and round and round. And then 5 minutes before we were to go, we just found ourselves drifting into a subject of conversation around something that interests me to do with gaming and play and organizations. And it suddenly turned out that he had this really interesting problem from a client that was just the sort of thing that I'm interested in working on. And it fell out through this conversation as an accident, that here was this thing that we could do together, that we're both excited by and that would be useful to him and to me. But it only dropped out entirely by accident because we weren't trying to make anything happen. We just got to know each other and relaxed and got comfortable. And
you know,
and,
Johnny,
go.
What you're saying now is so pertinent to what occupies my brain so often, that when you're, you know, it's the aha moments that you get when you don't plan them are the eureka moments of our lives.
Yeah.
It's where we allow ourselves not to be, and that allows for opportunity. The problem, back to what we were talking about, the boss, the worker, you know, everybody has their role. So they're trying to fill this void in the office, and it's all about ego. Okay, but if there's no boss, worker, this, that, what happens is you allow for other things to come in, for opportunities, for happenings, for the aha. And this is such a perfect example. I love it. Hello.
That's what they call a pregnant pause, isn't it, in the trade?
We're all stunned into silence, Penny.
No, I think it's what I think is, you know, when all my greatest experiences in life have been where I did something not because I needed to do it. I did it because of the experience of doing it. And you didn't need to go to lunch.
Yeah.
There was nothing in it for you. You allowed an experience to happen. You allowed to be present. You know, I've been listening to this the greatest web event, I think. Utilization of the web is with Oprah's course that she's doing with Eckhart on his book A New Earth. So I've been following it from, you know, just an interest in this whole book, but an interest in the social ramifications of what's going on here. Skype is allowing 1.9 million people to go to school once a week at 9 o'clock. Talk about the power of the web. This is why the web was created, to spread goodwill. And allowing 1.8 million people or 2 million people from all over the world, from Somalia. I mean, we had calls in from everywhere. This is the power of the web. This is utilizing it for the right purpose or for a great purpose.
Well, to be very evangelical there, Penny, a lot of people, and you will probably know more about this than I will, but a lot of people say, okay, how do we use the web to carry on doing our business the way it's always been done? Whereas actually, what's happening is the web is going its own direction and it's up to businesses to keep up.
Totally agree with that. And also, you know, that sort of touches a wee bit on what Doc's doing with VRM, vendor relationship management, that, you know, we're all out there, we're all talking, we're all saying what we're interested in, we're all expressing desires to buy or do or have services. And it should be that the companies are then falling over themselves to get to us with the right thing at the right time, delivered in the right way.
I think it'll be a kind of gradual evolution. I don't think, you know.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think all of a sudden like Amazon is going to be like selling oil to from the Persian Gulf.
No,
I mean,
it might happen.
It might happen, but it's you know, there's still vast infrastructures, you know, to run in the model.
Oh yeah, that's for sure. I mean, it's just at risk of raising a big thing just as we're meant to be winding down here. But just going back to what Penny was saying about, you know, the ability to connect and shared understanding and that this is what the web's for. And, you know, this is why I'm spending so much time reading about conventional religions and how, you know, I'm having been, I guess, anti most established religions in the past, I'm really interested in what this does to how we view spirituality and connectedness. You mentioned Eckhart Tolle, you know, and that whole thing about stripping away some of the cultural baggage we've got from centuries worth of one way of looking at the world is what gets me really excited about the web.
I know this guy called Father Stephen who used to, he's a priest, he used to teach at Ampleforth. and he, I guess he's been you know, quote unquote frocked or, you know, celibate for since he was 19, and he's in his 70s now. And when he talks about religion to me, you don't feel like he's giving any doctrine. He's kind of reverse engineering everything from the question, well, what's important? What's interesting?
Yeah.
And he has no trouble thinking of God as a metaphor rather than as some kind of gray bearded sky fairy.
But I think what the web is teaching religion is, and this is a powerful thing for me to say, but, you know, I think the web is teaching religion to say that it's about human beings, not about God.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Okay, yeah, the web is teaching companies that it's about the customer, what they want to pull, not what the company wants to push. I think this is this analogy of goes across everything, parenting. The web teaches parents that because you said so doesn't mean that's the way it needs to be. I mean, this is the theory of what eventually, if I ever get down to write something, this is what I want to talk about. This whole concept of a generation where you have on one side entitlement, you know, the new generation. I have employees that are 20, 25, and they have this sense of entitlement I've never seen in my life. It's a disease, I think. I think the American Health Association has to call it a disease and go through a 12-step program for this. But that aside, if you strip away all this entitlement and you get to the core of it, they're teaching us humility because they say, we control, we are pulling, we're the future. We're going to be the ones putting you in old age homes possibly. I don't know. But we're the future, and therefore you must listen to us. And I think that's the phenomenon of Barack Obama's rise to fame and success and getting all those votes is because the young people are there.
And he seems much more interested compared to some candidate. He seems, and we can argue how much of it is spin and how much is reality, but he seems much more interested in the voters than he does in himself, maybe.
Yeah, yeah, 100%.
I think the thing about Obama is, again, yeah, we argue separately about how much is spin, but the difference between Obama and Clinton seems to be so much about her effort to present herself as the person who can handle things, the person who can take the 3 a.m. phone call. You know, as if anybody at 3 a.m. is going to come up with the right answer, as if the right answer is going to be demanded at 3 a.m. in the morning and expected in 5 minutes. And Obama's language is more about we, and it's not the royal we that Mrs. Thatcher used that meant I. It is actually about this sense of, well, I'm only part of this. You're going to do this too. And even if it's only lip service, it's at least lip service to a more, to me, much more appealing and much more realistic message, which is that we are in this together. You know,
well, if he's faking, he's doing a really good job.
Yeah. I would say so, yeah.
If he's faking it, it'll come out.
Very, very wise thing. So, are you going to say something, Ian?
No, it was just, I mean, I think the thing that's common to all of these is authority.
Yes.
It kind of used to mean authority as conferred, which meant you could throw your weight around and not have to justify yourself. Nowadays, authority means having a compelling argument or idea.
I think it's wisdom.
It just attracts people because it makes sense and it works. And I think that's, you know, both in terms of commercial activity and in terms of being a manager in a business or being involved in religion, the onus is on people to come up with well-expressed, compelling ideas that work for as many people as possible.
I think about authorship, and I have this phrase, when I first heard it, it was a little obscure sounding, but feels really true to me, and fits quite well with the idea of an internet, a read-write internet. Is authority is the power to be the author of your own experience, not in terms of just getting whatever you want, not in that sense of entitlement that you were, you know, pointing to, Penny. But to feel like that you are part of it, that you create the experience, that your voice has value too, and that you don't take authority from the BBC anymore, is that you participate in what authority is.
So I've got questions, and we're going to wind this down, chaps. You know, to the people who are listening to this, thanks for your ears. What I'm guessing most people listening to this have jobs, they have to make a living, have to pay mortgages, have to turn up every day. I mean, let's say somebody works in a company. What advice could we say? What advice do you think we could tell people, you know, Monday morning when they go back into work, or whenever they go next going back to work? What could they bring into their offices and from this conversation and start using right away? Maybe using the wrong word.
Be brave.
Be brave? What about?
I mean, the thing I get the most pleasure out of working with people in corporates is they've begun to think that there's something in this, and they might be able to say what they think and have that authority that Johnny's just expressed. And so much of the time they devalue it, they'll argue against themselves, they'll dismiss what they think because everybody else must know that, and they won't say it. And I just love it when one of them has the guts to start up a blog and start saying stuff. And very often it takes being brave to do that.
Well, I don't know. Being in the other side of the coin of having employees or working for a corporation, I think being brave is important, but not to be stupid. You know, I think Hugh says something in his creative.
How to be creative.
How to be creative. You say something like, you know, be brave but have a day job. I think that's one of the laws. Right.
Yeah.
So you know, if Hugh would have went out and started his cartoons and relied on that as his success, he wouldn't have become a social marketer today because he would have starved to death. So the point is,
pretty much, yeah.
You know, the point, I think, yes, being brave is so important. What would I say tomorrow going into the office? I would say, you know, empty your mind once a day for allowing opportunity to happen. You know, don't follow your whole day that way, but give opportunity a chance at least once a day, and fantastic things will happen.
That's kind of what I would do too. I think. What would I do? I think what became easier for me in business, and it took me a while, it took me a long time, far more years than I care to admit, is I started getting compassionate, a lot more compassionate to people who are above me, if that makes any sense. You know, the manager, as opposed to being adversarial, saying, hey, this guy just has a job as well. This guy's just trying to do the best he can. And he's just trying to, you know, he doesn't want to get fired any more than I want to be fired, and he's got all these pressures on him as well. And I found once, this became especially true when, you know, in the wine business, where, you know, when we were selling to the big supermarkets in Britain, you know, there's only about five or six major buyers, and they're kind of treated like gods, these wine buyers, because they buy so much of it. And I started thinking, hang on, this guy is just this wine buyer. Okay, he may be quote unquote god, but he's just really just a guy in his late 30s with a pretty good salary, just trying to do the best job he can, depending on the dictates of his management. And so instead of saying, well, here's why you should buy our wine, please buy our wine, here's why you should buy our wine, it's good, it comes from South Africa, whatever, we started asking the question, well, what do you need to get ahead? Not as an apparatchik for a large supermarket chain, but what do you need as a human being? And let's work from there. And that moved our business forward tremendously.
I've been thinking about what I'd say. I think it's really hard to give advice because I think everyone's in different circumstances. I think I'd probably say, well, you know what to do.
Oh, brilliant. Brilliant. Okay, guys, I think that's kind of wrapping it up a little bit. Can we all say goodbye? My name is Hugh McLeod. Thank you very much. Ewan?
And my name is Ewan Seppel. Thanks very much as well.
Johnny?
I'm Johnny Moore. Thanks for listening.
And Penny, the rabbi. Penny, are you gone? Oh,
I had my mute on. Thank you guys. Well, have a fantastic weekend.
Oh dear. Oh, that's great. Well, this is technologically we're not we're pretty laissez-faire, so that's great. Okay, thanks everybody. Over and out. Goodbye.